This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On the Air.
Are you there, Sam?
Yep, hang on, I'm just turning that on.
Is our guest ready?
Yep, I've got the music ready.
Can you hear me okay?
Yep, sounds great.
Cool. Otago Access Radio, in partnership with Otago Polytechnic, brings you Blowing Bubbles.
Blowing Bubbles brings you positive conversations with people in their bubbles around the world.
We're curious about how people are finding new ways of life, being and problem solving. Every Wednesday, the Sustainable Lens team of Samuel Mann and Mawira Karatai reach out from our bubbles to chat with interesting and positive people around the world.
Broadcast on Otago Access Radio, 105.4 FM in Dunedin, and streamed and podcast on oar.org.nz.
Bringing joy, connection, kindness and peace in all the days ahead.
Welcome to Blowing Bubbles, positive conversations with people in their bubbles, their safe spaces around the world. I'm Samuel Mann, I'm at Otago Polytechnic in Dunedin. And I am joined today from Whakatane by Mawira Karatai. Kia ora, Mawira.
Kia ora, Sam. How's it going?
It's going very well indeed. What exciting things are happening in your life today?
I just took my first three loaves of bread down to Cafe Coco for sale. So that's a bit new. Selling the sourdough. Don't know how I feel about it. We'll see.
You can't help yourself.
If
you have these little projects and then they turn into businesses. All the time.
I know, and it's the problem, and I think it's a combination of I love business and I'm ADHD. Those two things together mean that everything turns into something. It can't just be a fun thing.
And who are we introducing today?
It is my absolute pleasure to introduce the wonderful Ash Creevy. Welcome, Ash. It is a joy to have you with us today.
Kia ora. I'm really excited to be here today. Slightly nervous, but I'm sure I'll get over that pretty quickly.
You will indeed, because it's all about you. Where did you grow up, Ash?
So I'm Dunedin born and bred. Grew up here, went to school here. Wasn't a massive fan of Dunedin growing up. It was, you know, small town, and I wanted to get out and experience the world. So I did that. Went out and lived in a few countries and places around the world, and eventually came back to Dunedin in my older years, and now love the place.
What was wrong with Dunedin when you were growing up?
Oh, look, I think it's just a bit of that teenaged angst. You know, you want to get out and live in big cities and be constantly entertained and do things. And Dunedin's, you know, relatively small on the world stage, and I think I just didn't appreciate what it had to offer when I was young. And now that I'm a bit older, I can see that it offers a lot and is actually quite big on the world stage. We're small but mighty as a little town, so I really like that. And now that I've got children as well, it's a great place to raise kids. It's, you know, there's no such thing as traffic, which is wonderful. I can't stand traffic. So yeah, love the place now.
So what did you want to be when you grew up?
Do you know, for a long time, I always wanted to be a lawyer. For a long time, that's what I wanted to be, and I never really understood why. I thought it was maybe I just like arguing, but I think for me, I have a really strong sense of justice, and that comes out in a lot of, you know, you do the personality tests online and things like that, and my sense of justice is really high. So I think it probably stems from that. I'm really glad I didn't go down that path, and I'm really glad I've managed to channel that sense of justice into an area such as sustainable business. Yeah.
So not going down the path of law, what path did you follow?
So my career was basically built in the travel and tourism industry. I worked in the travel and tourism industry for years and years and years, right from doing an internship with Tourism Queensland in Australia, working right through a whole lot of different roles, and actually ended up owning my own business, which was fun, which was great. But owning a travel company during COVID, not so much fun.
What sort of travel business?
So basically, it was a little travel agency. Where I had, you know, a bunch of clients that I helped out, arranging travel and trips and things. Lot of fun, but Yeah.
So what brought you home?
So obviously living overseas and doing the overseas thing was fun, and living in cities where you sit on a train for an hour each way to work and things like that. Great experience, you know, to do while you're young. But at the end of the day, home's home. It's familiar, and we, you know, I could see myself raising children back in New Zealand, back in Dunedin. And so that's what I did.
So you are currently doing a Masters of Sustainable Business. What got you there?
So I actually went and did my undergrad in international business. I started at 35 years old, so went in as a mature student, and had a lot of fun doing that, actually. I think it was quite a different experience to a lot of people who go and do a degree straight out of high school. So I got a lot out of that, and I went, after the travel industry sort of fell apart a little bit for me, went and did a couple of different jobs following that, but really found that it wasn't my calling. So I had to really dig deep and do a bit of soul searching as to where I wanted to land and where I wanted my career to go in the next direction. And I found that sustainable business fitted with a lot of my values. And so I started doing the masters as a part-time thing online while I was working. And at the start of this year, with the economic situation we were facing, decided to go and do it full-time. And complete all the papers full time, and take a year off working, which has been fantastic for me.
Those values that you'd had, where did they come from?
So as I mentioned before, I think the sense of justice in me, you know, expecting people just to do the right thing, is really high, and I think for me a lot of things changed when I had children. And you start thinking about the world you're leaving behind and the environment we're creating for them at the moment. And for me, that drives home the point that for a sustainable world, you know, I want to leave things as well as we can for my children to live in. Yeah.
Children and expecting people to do the right thing is always an interesting challenge. And maybe we can expand that out to sustainability, because you can't actually make them do the right thing.
That's part of my frustration, absolutely. And, you know, you sort of have to check yourself every now and then and think, you know, what I think is the right thing isn't necessarily what someone else thinks is the right thing. So this is where the sustainability course has been really valuable for me in gauging a range of opinions and embracing a whole lot of theories around that. And how do we, you know, compromise, if compromise is an option in certain cases, and how do we apply decision-making theories and things to complex situations. Yeah.
Let's take your music choice. Who have we got? Ben Harper with My Own Two Hands. His Own Two Hands, not mine. Why this one?
So this is a song from my childhood. Ben Harper was, you know, constantly on the tape deck and then on the CD player back when I was younger. And this song for me is, I think it sort of embraces the idea that when things seem a little bit too hard, or, you know, it's only me, what kind of difference can I make, really? It's a song that embraces the fact that we can all make a difference. You know, as he says in the song, you know, I can change the world with my own two hands. And I think that's really important. I think a lot of times in the past I felt really sort of small in terms of the difference I can make. You know, I'm only one person, what difference can it really make? But at the end of the day, if we all make a difference, if we all do just that little bit, put in that little bit of effort, it can add up to a lot.
I can change the world with my own two hands, make a better place with my own two hands, make a kinder place. Oh, with my own two hands, with my own two hands, with my own two hands. I can make a peace on earth with my own two hands, and I can clean up the earth, Lord, with my own. with my own two hands. Oh, with my own, oh, with my own two hands. I'm gonna make it a brighter place. I'm gonna make it a safer place. I'm gonna help the human race.
Sprite of the forest of Orokinui, Dunedin's favourite goddess, Tahu Mackenzie.
Kia ora koutou, nga mihi arahanu, kia koutou ko tahu ahau. I hope you're all having the best day, beautiful superstars in your beloved universes. And I really hope, wherever you are and whatever's happening around you, this journey that we're all on together is proving to be very rewarding, very sustaining and illuminating for you more and more each day, who you are, a triumph of nature's art, perfect, unique, and here, making things better. Thank you. Now, I know that for us all, the last several years have been very tough, and as a species, we've had to adapt to unimaginable and completely unexpected changes. And, you know, we've all had to come together and we've all had to share this experience of this global pandemic all over the world. And it has changed us, every single one of us. It has shaped our understanding of consensus reality, of our external world and our internal world. And for all of us, we are still in recovery. We are still processing what has taken place, And it's so important we give ourselves and each other the time, the love, the care, the compassion, the empathy, the sympathy, the companionship to traverse this journey together. And of course, as I speak to you now, I am driving along one of my favourite stretches of road. And this is the road that leads from Aotearoa to Dunedin out to the beautiful Otago Peninsula. And we see a landscape that has been highly modified. Forests have been removed and farmland has been created in their place. We see houses where people have lived, some for more than 100 years, but all these lives dotted around us, some more obvious than others, and this beautiful tapestry that they form. And of course for me, I find such comfort, such beauty, such peace in the living world. And our human world bewilders me at times, but is a testament for me to our creative capacity as a species. The human world, of course, is our creation, our collective creation, and it continues to be so. We're at a stage now, of course, where we have created artificial intelligence, and we see a whole new layer and level of that creative energy being expressed. And I marvel at these aspects of the human world, but I also hope that the technologies we create, the frameworks of meaning we create, the relationships that we create, all return to what I perceive as the real world, which is the living world. And of course the human world is an integral part, but it is only one part of the living world, in my opinion. So here I go. I'm driving past some beautiful young takoka trees that are growing up to the light. And I went to visit St Kilda Kindergarten this morning, and we're all pretending to be the trees, gobbling up the sunshine, making fresh air, taking in the breath that air. And of course, these beautiful trees that surround us bring such comfort when we are needing that companionship. You can sit at the base of a tree and, for me, really enjoy the connection that you can feel with that beautiful life form. Some of our trees, of course, have been growing tall and straight and strong for hundreds of years. And when we sit at their feet, oh, what an honour it is. And the young saplings, as they're making their way towards the light, what a privilege, what a pleasure it is to share that space, that sacred space of growth and change with them. So I really hope for you that you are having moments in your day when you're able to connect with other life forms in a way that is meaningful to you. And of course for me, being part of this show is a huge honour and privilege. I really appreciate it. And I want to thank Sam and the whole Blowing Bubbles team for having me. Thank you. I'll look forward to talking to you again soon. Ka kite!
Ash, we're going to listen to your podcast shortly. What would you like to tell us about the person you interviewed, and what in particular would you like our listeners to listen out for?
Okay, so I interviewed Anne Gattenby. So Anne's actually a friend of mine who also did the Masters of Sustainable Business and graduated earlier this year. And I've actually worked with Anne in companies before. She's a real inspiration when it comes to what she's done in her past and what she's doing now. Really interesting, the things that she's doing in her industry to make a difference. So I think for me, listening out for just those sustainable practices that maybe we don't think about every day. Anne currently works in the meat exporting industry, and her thesis for the Masters was actually around the personal protection equipment, the PPE gear that they wear, and the circularity of that. So I found that really interesting, and it's not something that we would normally think about in terms of sustainability. But you know, again, going back to the theme that all these little things add up, And especially New Zealand being a, you know, a heavy meat export country, we rely on it a lot. So just knowing that these companies actually take sustainability seriously in all aspects, I think is really neat and really important. Kia ora everyone, my name is Ash Creevy and I am currently a Masters of Sustainable Business student at the University of Otago. So, having worked in the New Zealand meat exports industry myself, I wanted to dive deeper into the slightly lesser known and understood sustainability issues that affect the industry and what is currently being undertaken to address certain issues. So it's been a few years now since the COVID-19 pandemic, and with that, I read in a book called The Environmental Impact of COVID-19 by Ratani and Hussein, came a massive rise in waste production during the pandemic, with some businesses reporting a 500% increase. So a large proportion of this waste came from the use of PPE, or personal protection equipment, within the health sector, most of which were single-use products. Now, UNICEF and the World Health Organization reported massive shortages of PPE worldwide due to the huge increase in use. Ultimately, most of it ended up in landfill after being used a single time. So this got me thinking and linking it back to the meat exports industry here in New Zealand. Given that single-use personal protection equipment is widespread in the food industry here in New Zealand, what are we doing, or what could we be doing, to minimise what goes to waste? So I'm here today with Anne Gattenby to discuss the topic of sustainability in the food industry, and more specifically, PPE waste minimisation. So kia ora, Anne. Thank you so much for allowing me time with you today to discuss these issues. To start off with, I'm wondering if you could give us a bit of a brief background on how you got involved in the food industry here in New Zealand.
Kia ora, Ash. I grew up on a summer fruit orchard in central Otago, so I first started working in the food industry for money when I was about 8, and I started on $1.50 an hour. And by the time I finished primary school, I was a MAF quality inspector for the release of cherry fruit to the export market. And then once I was at high school, I got an after-school job at KFC and really got curious about why the chips had to be cooked at a certain temperature and held for a certain time, and the chicken could only be held for 90 minutes. And as I asked more and more questions, my chemistry teacher said that I should consider food science, and I ended up studying the Food Science Bachelor of Science at the University of Otago. And then I had a master brewer head of department who kind of led me to loving beer. And so I ended up working in brewing and some chocolate and now red meat.
So I'm wondering if you could tell us, what is your role or title with the company that you're with now?
So I'm a sustainability analyst now, and my role is to provide the data to bring about change within the organisation, and to provide the data to make sure that our operations are transparent to our customers and consumers, kind of act on the philosophy that radical transparency is the way to counteract any challenges of greenwashing or green crowding or green hushing or any of those other things.
Just on that, I guess the question arises then, do you think that it's now an expectation of stakeholders that there is sustainability employees within organisations in the food industry in New Zealand?
I don't know if it's necessary employees. My manager is always saying that a sustainability team should stay small, because sustainability should be part of everyone's job. But sustainability commitments, I think, are really necessary, especially if you're exporting food from New Zealand. So the progress within the UK and Europe on sustainability legislation is much faster than here. And in the US, there's a real consumer market for, kind of, how would I describe it, goodness. We talk about goodness from the farms the world needs. Yeah. So trying to have a positive product that they can pay a bit more for, knowing that they've, for example, offset their carbon emissions or the carbon emissions throughout the value chain.
You've given us a bit of background as to how you got involved in food science, but I question is, how did you get involved in the sustainability area of the food industry? What led you to that?
I always had a real interest in it. So when I was at primary school, I bought this book, The Young Person's Guide to Saving the Planet, which was a Greenpeace publication from the Lucky Book Club, which I love. And then I kind of got interested in food and eventually ended up working overseas and suddenly realized that my impact as an individual was now really high because I wanted to fly home to New Zealand and see my family. And that kind of made me look at my impact and what I could be doing to reduce impact in other areas. And that kind of made me realize that the organizations that I was working for had high impacts. And so I started with little things like asking for paper recycling in a brewery I worked in or things like that, you know, the kind of simple things.
Yeah.
And then I worked in a lot of really big food companies overseas, and waste just kind of disappeared because it was so big. You know, it would take an hour to walk around the site. I didn't really see it going places. But when I returned to New Zealand and started working in smaller companies and had roles that branched across more things, I began to see how many skips were being taken away full of rubbish from my team. And when we got really, really busy, I'd have to order in an extra skip to be taken away, whether it was recycling or landfill. So my desire to work more in sustainability and the environment just started to increase quite exponentially then. So I kind of got involved in supporting the carbon footprint work at a place that I was working, a brewery. But I wanted to know more and I wanted to do more. So I eventually enrolled in the Masters of Sustainable Business, which recently graduated with, and then was lucky enough to pick up a sustainability analyst role midway through that master's degree and to get to do sustainability full time, which is just great. Probably say in the UK, I worked for some companies with amazing histories. So for example, Roundtree's and Cadbury's that came from Quaker Root. And the other side of sustainability that really appeals to me is the social sustainability and looking after the people in your community who are also working and making the product that the company is selling. So, yeah.
And I guess that's an issue that doesn't really get talked about a lot, does it? The social sustainability aspect of the food industry and, the famous story of Cadbury's creating a whole town for their workers and things. There's some quite interesting histories there when it comes to that, isn't there?
Yeah. I really think sometimes that looking backward has the answers for things to do in the future, you know.
I agree.
Things like providing physios for your staff when they're doing manual work, supporting them to make sure they can afford decent food, that kind of thing.
It's not exactly an industry sustainability isn't something you've fallen into. It seems to have been a gradual sort of progression for you. In that sense, what are some of the positive advancements that you've seen or noticed in the food industry here in New Zealand, especially over the years?
I think the good news is that the market for sustainability products is growing, and the number of customer surveys that we get requesting sustainability information is growing. So there's a market pressure for sustainability improvements, and there's also the pressure within the organization, whether that's from governance and being aware of the risk of not doing things properly, or from employees themselves, you know, like I was a few years back asking for paper recycling. So I guess there's positive movement coming from those different pressures. And one of the things that I really love is how well sustainability and environmental concerns are talked about at schools now. Because I think it's such a challenge, and knowing that we just have more and more young people coming through into the workforce who get the need for sustainability is one of the biggest positives of them all, I think.
So As I previously mentioned, single-use PPE makes up a large proportion of the waste created within medical organisations, and it dramatically increased during COVID. But what I'm wondering is, could you tell us a little bit about PPE within the meat industry, and within your organisation, what sort of PPE is being used, and what happens to it once it has been used once?
So I suppose it's important to say that some of the PPE within the meat industry is required by regulatory frameworks. So whether that's health and safety legislation or food safety legislation, and that's probably one of the reasons for PPE. So that you kind of get three causes, perhaps. One's the safety of your employees, another one's their physical comfort, and then the other one is food safety, hygiene type protection of product. And so those three causes lead to PPE requirements that we tend to break down by hands, body, face, and feet. So for your hands, you could have a blue nitrile glove, which is purely about comfort. It can be quite cold working in a refrigerated area that also could be quite wet. So a nitrile glove is used there. But anyone who's using a knife will also have a steel mesh glove as well. On your body, you'll have steel mesh to protect you from cuts if you're using a knife once again. And then you'll have your fabric workwear that's laundered and issued by the company and returned for you to wear the next day, you know. But you'll also potentially or typically have a plastic apron as well. And that plastic apron is about protecting your body and your core from getting wet or dirty. And if you can wash it when you go to a break, and if your clothing got dirty, then you'd be a risk to the food. So it's all kind of intertwined. Nitrile gloves are obviously disposable. Aprons, we have a mix of reusable and disposable aprons. For your face, there's a face shield for splashing in some roles. Safety glasses, if you're not wearing a face shield and there's a risk of debris getting into your eyes. Helmet, earmuffs and earplugs to protect the employee, the team member, from noise. And then on your feet, you'll have steel cap boots or steel cap gumboot, depending on the area. That's about protecting your feet. And in the case of gumboot, they're also waterproof and easily washable.
So I'm wondering, do you know offhand what percentage of that PPE gear is single-use plastic?
We have a mix, and we're kind of working all the time to increase the amount of reusable item. Oh, I forgot hairnets as well, which are definitely not reusable. So I measured it back in 2022, and we've definitely had shifts within the organisation since then. So you could ask me in a few more months, because we're doing some quantitative waste audits this year, which might be early next year by then. But we have 14 processing plants, and across those, some will be more prone to use disposable items and some will be more prone to use reusable item. One of the best sites restricted the use of disposable aprons to just one employee role on the site. So there's some really awesome initiatives that are coming from our people managing operations.
So it sounds like it's certainly an issue that's been addressed or is in the process of being addressed. I guess that leads me to ask the question of, what are the major barriers to eliminating single-use items altogether?
Yeah, so as part of my master's project, I looked in detail at PPE use and the practices that drive PPE behaviour. So I took a systems-based approach and used social practice theory. Elizabeth Shove developed it for environmental-type sustainability behaviours and tried to break that down by interviewing team members and asking about how they use PPE, asking about the materials, and asking about skills and beliefs around PPE use. And we also engaged a company called Circularity Limited, led by Louise Nash, and we measured the circularity of our PPE using the Circularity Transition Indicator tool from the WBCSD. And so from those two processes, we were kind of able to understand what the barriers are for PPE use or for reusable or recyclable PPE. And so a major one when it's disposable plastic, disposable plastics are frequently LDPE, and so they are recyclable. They're a soft plastic film. However, if you get organic debris on them, then it can start to smell, and that can cause issues for recycling plants. So that organic contamination and being able to wash a disposable apron or a disposable glove or hairnet is one of the barriers that we face within the meat industry. Within New Zealand itself, its geographical location is a bit of a barrier for plastics recycling. So if we were based in Europe, we could use a recyclable, reusable apron and return it to the factory that we purchased it from, where they'd melt it down and turn it back into a reusable apron when it finally failed. So we've been doing trials with that plastic in our plants, and we have some whole departments wearing aprons made from the plastic now, but we don't have access to that shipping route to Europe, and so we're having to find ways to repair and ways to recycle within our location. My work has invested in a feasibility study for chemical recycling of plastics when they get broken down to their component resin, so that opportunity for the future. Sometimes regulatory frameworks get in the way of recycling PPE. So, for example, we use a white gumboot and we return any used worn gumboots back to the gumboot factory in New Zealand, where they're melted down and turned back into gumboots, which is a really great story of circularity. The only difficulty is that in that process, you get some faint streaks coming through the gumboot, so they're no longer pure white gumboot. And the New Zealand food safety regulations require that a gumboot must be white. And so a gumboot with a streak in it would be rejected and thrown out by MPI inspectors and unable to be used on the floor. So that's another barrier.
So I guess putting PPE aside, I just want to finish with a question. What makes you feel positive about the future in sustainability?
I think that the absolute dynamic nature of sustainability. In the master's course, to read a paper that was more than 3 years old was probably unlikely, unless it was a foundational concept, like what the definition of sustainability was. Yeah. And I like that I see a lot of knowledge seeking and collaboration and understanding of change dynamics and the use of storytelling. The fact that there's trillions of green investment funding around worldwide accessible in the market pressures, and obviously the youth as well. So I think all those things are what keep me going and keep trying.
Thank you so much for your time, Anne.
Thanks, Ash.
Suggested it before the interview, before your podcast played. Anne is an incredibly positive and motivating person. What was your big takeaway from your podcast experience with her?
I think the positivity that Anne gives out for me is really important. We need more people like that in the world who, you know, we see the news every day and everything seems sort of a little bit hopeless sometimes with what's going on, and not just climate change, but current events going on. And Anne has a really good grasp of her area of expertise, and being positive about that and positive about the outcomes that can be achieved. And so I think my main takeaway from talking to Anne is just that I came away feeling a lot better about things as well, especially in the industry that she's in, and making a difference. I think that's really important.
It is. And how do you think it will inform your practice going forward?
I think it's important for me to keep a positive frame of mind around everything that's going on, and maybe not take so much notice of the current events going on in the world, but also look at what people are doing. And also notice that there's a lot of things going on behind the scenes in industries we don't always think about, and the changes they're making that help people and planet. You know, the meat export industry, being big in New Zealand, as I mentioned previously, and is making a real difference in that sector. So for me, just remembering that there's a lot of stuff going on out there, a lot of changes being made that we don't necessarily hear about or read about every day, but are happening.
That is a beautiful thing. And do you think that, like, through the course of your, the last paper that we worked on together, especially, you kind of engaged in some action research, which I think you're particularly suited to. Do you think that change is possible when, you know, like the kind of change that we need to make the world a better place? Is it possible? And if you could wave a magic wand right now to make it happen, what would you do?
I think it is absolutely possible. I think what it would need to change and actually make a massive difference is some systematic overhaul of the way we think and act in society. The way we consume products at the moment is completely unsustainable. I think we need to be thinking as a collective how we approach these things, everything from what we consume to what we eat, how we work. And I think there are steps being taken in order to address these things. I just think that a little bit faster pace to meet those changes would be great, and not encounter the roadblocks that we have been encountering. Yet science is really important in all of this. I think there's a lot of science out there. I think the answers are out there. I just think there's a lot of roadblocks being put up by people to hold us back from achieving what we really do need to achieve to make a difference.
If you were going to make a job for yourself where you got to make that difference, what would the job be?
I think we need to talk to people on a different level sometimes. So maybe a job where we engaged with people on how they consume, how they act, how they work. But instead of dictating how people do these things, I think we need to work with people on different levels and approach it in a way that makes it a bit more... It shows them the benefits that would affect them. We need to show them why it's a good idea for them and the benefits they can reap from these sorts of things. And all that sort of information and knowledge is out there. I think messaging is a massive problem in the sustainability industry, where a lot of people see it as sort of people saying, do this, do that, but the benefits are sort of downplayed or sort of miscommunicated a little bit. So I think sort of the communication is really important in order to sort of speak to people on another level.
Ash, a systemic overhaul of the way we think and act and needing to talk on different levels seem like extremely worthy goals. How do we do that in a context of business that still relies on us buying more stuff?
So I think the way we consume and the way business is done at the moment are not sort of conducive to a sustainable future. So in a way, sustainability needs to start from a consumer point of view, and we need to change the way that we are consuming. But I think there also is a very strong case for business to change the way they operate as well. So I think businesses these days, a lot of businesses, not all, are quite short-sighted in terms of they're there to make profit. And that's sort of the only way they think about business. So they'll do whatever it takes to make a good profit, but they're not looking at the long-term profitability of their company. So using the example of, you know, making cheap goods and selling them cheap, etc., and making a quick buck, I think there's a really strong case for businesses to move to sustainable products that last longer, that might cost a little bit more, but actually favors the consumer in the long run. So there's the classic case of the theory of boots, where, you know, a cheap pair of boots might cost you $30, but they only last a few months, So you're buying a new pier all the time, whereas a really good pier might cost you $300 but last years. So economically, it makes sense to buy the more expensive pier. I think the problem we've got at the moment with the social inequality that's going on is we don't have a system that's designed for that kind of consumption. And we move to a system where it is fairer for people to be able to afford goods that last longer and therefore cheaper overall for them, I feel like a sustainable world and is not actually that out of reach. But there's a lot of things we need to do to get there in the first place. And social inequality is a massive problem. And if we can sort of get to the underlying factors of a lot of these things, then I think that helps the overall sustainability targets that we need to reach.
I liked, talking about boots, I liked when Anne was talking about the gum boots that they wear in the freezing works and that they can send them back to be reconstructed into new boots, but they're not white anymore, or they're kind of a dirty white, and that's not acceptable. And it sort of, it highlighted for me that not only is she working in an area where there's an awful lot of waste that hadn't occurred to me, but the barriers, the systemic barriers that are in the place of making the sorts of changes that you might want to make. Even putting aside the social equity thing, which is a whole nother dimension that you're just mentioning, can you think of any changes that we could make as a community, individuals within that community or wider society, that would encourage entrepreneurs and businesses to make the changes that you're looking for towards a system where people can afford to buy the good stuff?
So I think it starts with, I think it's a compromise. So we need to come from a consumer point of view, but look at it from a business point of view as well. So from a consumer point of view, we need those social inequalities sort of addressed so that families can afford to be, or people can afford to be buying products that last longer. But we also need to make the business case for organizations and businesses to move into producing goods that are sustainable. So I think there's a lot of compromise that needs to be made in terms of, I guess, food groups. First, do the businesses need to lower the price of their goods and make better products, or do consumers need to be willing to pay more? I think a real strong case for all parties to sort of be coming together. But this is a problem that exists on multiple levels of society. So it needs to be addressed from everything, from a grassroots level through to government level. And, you know, it doesn't help where things like, you know, social welfare and things is changing all the time, and families are finding themselves in economic situations where, you know, the cost of living crisis we're going through. I think the world's just, it's very tumultuous at the moment with what's going on. And I think there's a lot of worry out there about, you know, families aren't thinking about sustainability. They're not thinking about, you know, am I going to buy a product that's going to last a long time? They just need a product. The kids need new shoes or new clothes or whatever. And businesses are out there just making a profit. You know, there's a very short-sightedness going on from a lot of companies. Fortunately, there are a lot of companies and organizations out there that do look and think long-term. But we need that to become the norm rather than the exception.
I think a big part of the solution is acceptance of as products as a service or function as a service. I'm not buying a pair of boots that are going to last forever. I'm renting boots. I'm renting the concept of boots, and the company then has the incentive to make these boots last forever and be repairable and so on. What are your plans for your thesis?
So I'm looking at the aviation industry, and in particular carbon offsetting, and looking at the programs that they offer, but also consumer perspectives on carbon offsetting programs. So I'm interested in, do people understand what programs, how effective they are, where their money goes when they offset, what are the barriers to people offsetting? But also looking at the businesses that offer, or the airlines that offer these offsetting programs. Is it just a marketing stunt, or are these offsetting programs actually embedded in corporate strategy? So that's where my interest is.
Maybe we should ask somebody that used to run an airline. I was talking on the show a few weeks ago with Tim Lynch. We're talking about putting things like food miles on restaurant menus. And he says they have no effect because you're there to have dinner. What am I supposed to do with this number that you've put beside this? Do you get the same feeling for travel that it's like, yeah, but I need to travel, or I want to go on holiday? Knowing about the miles, knowing about what its offsets, do I really care?
My gut feeling is that people do care. I think that people are, there's not enough education and information out there at the moment for people to be making informed decisions. I think if people actually knew how little it costs to offset a flight, I think it would become second nature to choose to offset it. More importantly, I think it would be better if we just incorporated offsetting as part of an airline tax and just incorporated into a ticket in the first place. And for airlines and the aviation industry to actually just take ownership of that and implement some programs that make a real difference. I often ask my friends and people, you know, what do you think it costs to offset a flight from, say, Auckland to Wellington? And I've had people say everything from $5 to $100. Like, people just have no idea. And if people actually knew that the total cost to offset that flight is $1.50, I think people would just pay it and not care. So I think there's a real lack of education and knowledge. And I think that the aviation industry needs to take a little bit of ownership of that.
I have some questions to end the show and negative time to ask them, so I'm going to have to wriggle. What is the biggest success you've had in the last couple of years?
I think for me, completing my undergrad and graduating a few years ago in my late 30s was a real achievement for me. Having to manage family, children, and work while also studying and achieving that was a massive undertaking for me, but a real sense of success.
What's your superpower?
Resilience. I think resilience is my superpower. Having a lot thrown at me, but being able to keep going and still do the things that I'm doing.
Do you consider yourself to be an activist?
Not in the traditional sense, no. I don't think I am. I think I'd like to make differences and make changes in different ways than what a traditional role of an activist would look like.
So what motivates you? What gets you out of bed in the morning?
My children, absolutely. Being able to make a better world for them and giving them every opportunity that I've had and not had, and even more.
I liked how Anna talked about the impact of the books she had as a kid, The Young Person's Guide to Saving the Planet, and I was thinking about the Ladybird book that I had, the What on Earth Are We Doing? You got some appropriate change moments for your kids?
Do you know, I think it's really interesting to see what the kids are coming up with these days in the sustainability realm and what they're picking up as children. They know a lot more than what I would have a few years ago in terms of climate change and sustainability and things. I think it's almost coming second nature for children these days, which I think is amazing. And, you know, being inclusive and all these sorts of things. I think that gives me real hope for the future. So I don't think it's in terms of a book as such, but I think what they learn and what they come home with is really special.
Lastly, do you have any advice for our listeners?
I think my main piece of advice would be to never give up hope that what you're doing is not enough. I think every little change we can make makes an absolute difference. And that can be tiny little things we do at home to big policy changes we can have influence over. I think just every little thing makes a difference.
Thank you for that. Mawira.
Ash, thank you very much for a really thoughtful podcast and very thought-provoking as well. And for our interview today, and I was thinking, I've got this little routine where every time I take a flight, I plant a tree, and so I've got a real fruit forest growing in my garden now. So there are so many different things that we can do, whether it's paying over cash or doing something positive like planting our own trees. It's just a small thing that I do, but it reminds me that, you know, that we can actually do that stuff. So thank you. And all the best with your thesis, and thank you so much for your contribution in our classroom. You're kind of like the big brother to everybody in the class, and I've seen the support that you give to everybody in that learning space, and I've really enjoyed sharing the space with you. Thank you for bringing all of yourself to our mahi, and we wish you all the best.
And thank you for those words. It's yeah, it's been interesting, as I said before, coming back to study sort of at my age. I'm 41 now, but what I see coming out in some of these, the younger generation that I've done my master's with, there is some exceptional talent coming through. Just blows me away at the ideas and thoughts and, yeah, talent that is coming through. Puts me to shame a little bit, but I'll still go out there and do my best. But I appreciate everything that you've offered the class. This paper that we've just done has been unreal. The opportunities for discussion and things has been really important. I think some papers sort of miss that sometimes. To create a space where people can sort of share their thoughts and things. And that's been evident in this paper. It's been awesome.
Yeah.
We've been enjoying listening to them as well. We are going out to Tim Buckley, The Future's So Bright. You've been listening to Blowing Bubbles, positive conversations with people in their bubbles, their safe spaces around the world. Brought to you by the Sustainable Lens team, which is brought to you by Otago Polytechnic. We broadcast on Otago Access Radio every Wednesday afternoon at 3 and streamed and podcast on oar.org.nz. You can find us on Facebook. We had a contribution today from Tahu McKenzie. Mawira Karatai introduced Ash Creevy with his episode of Coming Up for Air. That was Anne Gattenby. That was Blowing Bubbles. I'm Samuel Mann. We hope you enjoyed the show. Mate wa.
This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On the Air.